when you have great coaches, then after you have great coaches, you get great players, you have a great organization, and you tell them one thing. Just win, baby.
Just missing Josh Jacobs all over the field. The Raiders pretty much eliminated themselves from any thought of division. And it is this, people want to say it's a lack of wide receivers, which is true. Some of this has to fall on Carr. I'm sick of the stands. I'm sick of the fans. I'm sick of the nonsense. They need to get themselves together. And we're at the point where it's year six. I'm really not impressed. When the money's on the table, he doesn't come through. And I don't want to hear about how in 2016 he had all these comebacks. In games that mattered down the stretch, what has he ever done for this team? With that, I'm going to bring in my co-host. We have a lively show tonight. He is the pride of Morgan State, the pride of Maryland, the occasional parts of Virginia, and just that little sliver of Delaware. My man, Malik Obi. Obi, what's good?
You add something new every time. But look, I am good, T. Look, and just to go right in on what you just said about Carr, what people need to understand is it's not a witch hunt on Carr. And you have to emphasize the fact that it's been 6 years, but this is a part that people often leave out. Carr, and this is why the 2016 is important. We saw growth from 2014 to 2016. We saw peak Carr, I mean, the top three MVP, finalists or whatever. Like, when you see the best in somebody or what they can be, you can't go backwards. That's the thing that people understand. We've seen Carr play good football. So to go anything beyond that is unfathomable. So we spent the time, okay, the injury, he healed from the injury. Last year was like, okay, well, he's taking a step, you know, he's taking a step with confidence. Can't wait to see year two with Gruden. Now what? You got Gruden for another year. You're familiar with the playbook. You're familiar with everything. And what people understand is it's like Carr is a very efficient quarterback for the most part. He's a game manager, and you know he's up there with Cousins with the for the completion percentage and everything. But what matters is all these stats don't even matter. At the end of the day, we know what's going to need to take place over the next, let's say, 5 to 7 years. The division goes through Patrick Mahomes, whoever he has on the team. Last year's defense sucked, and he had a great offense. This year he has a great offense. The defense has improved in some areas. The division has to go through him, not Joe Flacco, not an old-ass Phillip Rivers. The division goes through Mahomes. So with that being said, you have to – if the Raiders went that – like we saw so many games with good competition games with top quarterbacks, and then you have quarterbacks that are mid-tier to top 10 level, like a Matt Stafford, who when healthy, you know you're going to get a dogfight with him. When this is the sixth time that Derek Carr has played Kansas City in Arrowhead. I mean, you can debunk a lot of these excuses when you look at other quarterbacks through history, guys that are born in California, stuff like that, that perform in cold weather. The excuses go on forever. I mean, I see people talking about, you mentioned it, I know you're talking about right now with the wide receiver situation. So what about 2016 when Amari Cooper and Michael Crabtree both had 1,000-yard season, and they were held to 50 yards combined in Kansas City, in Arrowhead. No touchdowns. Carr threw no touchdowns, no picks, 117 yards, excuse me. What about that? When do the excuses end? Derek Carr has to perform better. I mean, even in the 2016 season, he beat, I think, two teams that ended up with a winning record, and then he wasn't available to play in the playoffs in a game that he should have very well won if he was available. What about that? I mean, these things, at some point in time, we have to say, this is not a first year, it's not a second year quarterback. This is not a 6-year quarterback that was on the bench and is coming into the system and picking up the slack for somebody like Mason Rudolph or Devlin Hodges. Look at the Steelers situation. The Steelers are depleted on the offensive side of the ball. We're not talking about the star-studded defense. We're talking about on the offensive side of the ball. James Conner has regressed a bit. James Washington, they're still trying to find a wide receiver too. And Juju is getting double-teamed most of the time. These guys are still winning games. You know, so you have a dominant rookie running back who's playing hurt, giving you all he's got. He's sixth in the league in carries. What more can you ask from him? Derek Carr has to step up, bottom line.
For me, Obi, it is the tough part of it, because when you sit there and you look at how this team is constructed, people really can't blame the wide receiver. They can't blame the roster because it's Gruden and Mayock. I saw when people wanted to blame Reggie McKenzie. Reggie McKenzie's gone. He's not coming back. Let that man enjoy himself in Miami and trying to build that team. But they want to absolve Gruden and Mayock. And I'm sorry, like, as good as John Gruden has made this offense, I look at somebody like Trevor Davis, who they traded a 6th-round draft pick when they cut him for, like, he was like a fall intern. They got to stop having wide receivers. Like, he made on that 4th-and-1, first of all, the play call, I couldn't stand it, because you have a running back that can get a yard. Second of all, how do you take the wrong gap? How do you miss? How do you miss that, Obi? And it just, that was a pivotal moment. And I'm sorry, that dude has really just not been, he had that one end around where he scored and people were like, oh, this is going to be, you know, people all excited. I'm like, he had one highlight.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry, Terrell Williams he's not a number one. Our guy, Danny, shout out to Danny, he said how, and he actually tweeted the actual article where Gruden and Mayock said they envisioned Terrell Williams before they even traded for Antonio Brown being the number one. He's not a number one. He's not a number two. He can't get separation. He's barely number three. And you got like Keenan Dawes, Marcella Aitman, you got Zay Jones. None of these guys can get open. And I'm sorry, between the linebacker core and the wide receiver core, the Raiders don't really have those two positions filled. And I know that people want to, you know, praise Hunter Renfrow for being able to catch everything, but he doesn't get open. Like, if you're averaging about 10 yards a catch or even a little bit less, why are you there? Like, mm-hmm. You could literally find in this draft guys like, oh, what's the dude's name? James Prochet from SMU. I know that you had your mock draft list. And James mm-hmm. Prochet, Jalen Reagor, guys like that who can work the slot. Who's that guy? Devin DuVernay out of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Guys who are bigger, faster, and can create separation. And the one thing that gets on my nerves most is when you have people in the fan base who get upset that when you question draft picks. I'm still questioning the fact that Cleveland Farrell has more he has more offside penalties than he does sacks.
Mm-hmm.
How's that going to work? And I just, for me, it doesn't help the cause when you just can't trust anyone. Like, you can't trust the offense. You can't they have the worst linebackers, honestly, I think I've seen. Even when they were like 2-14 or 4-12, they had better linebackers. This linebacker core is terrible.
bad. I mean, it's really bad. And the thing is that the sad thing is that people expect that. Raiders fans expect that. Like, I mean how many years are we from Beaker? How many, rest in peace, Thomas Howard? You know, this that was a very long time ago in retrospect. This is what people expect. People expect, you know, there are certain teams that do, they have tendencies that, bad tendencies that people expect and going to understand. We know the Bengals are cheap. You know what I'm saying? We know certain things about certain teams. We know that the Raiders do not value linebackers early. And this is not people putting it on as a Gunther thing. No, this is something that's been going on since Rolando McClain. You know what I'm saying? We took McClain and then that didn't work. And then ever since, we've been stuck with below average guys. And that also goes to my fear outside of the injury that he suffered. That goes to my fear that the Raiders will overlook Dylan Moses because of the fact that he's an Alabama guy. And I know people say, don't worry about, you know, don't look at the helmet, look at the player. But I think that happens in the league just because, you know, we have more than enough proof that GMs and front office people are, you know, logical and illogical human beings like the rest of us. They make mistakes. I mean, we saw a damn kicker go in the first round of the NFL draft. You know, so, well, excuse me, on more than one occasion. So, with that being said, I mean, it's like, these things happen. It's just crazy to think about. This is a draft where, let's say that the Raiders, you know, land in the 10 to 14 area. They're going to have a shot with the Bears, excuse me. They're going to have a shot at Dylan Moses, Isaiah Simmons, like maybe, and then they're gonna have guys like Kenneth Murray. They're gonna have options early if they want to go that route.
There's no excuse this year, and I don't understand how you look at all the coverage linebackers who are in this draft. You look at people like Troy Dye, like Isaiah Simmons, even like. We have a guy that you were high on, OB, that his draft profile comes out tomorrow, and Akeem Davis Gaither, the outside linebacker from Appalachian State. I watched a lot of his film, or as much as I could find. People are going to sit there and critique his size, where he's about 250, 215, 220 pounds, but he is all over the field. He is lights out in coverage. Like, people have this antiquated thought of what a linebacker should look like and should play like.
Right.
And to me, it doesn't really work because the days of Devontaze Burfict being able to play three downs are over. They got to stop having these retreads. And it doesn't work for Oakland. And it doesn't, I mean, it, I just, they need to fix this. And I just, for me, it's, they need to do something. And I don't quite get how they're sitting there and they just don't want to address it. And Paul Gunther's got to go. Like, he's at the point as a defensive coordinator where he's got to go. Like, you look at how the Bengals succeeded. It was Mike Zimmer and Marvin Lewis. He needed that second hand where in Oakland, everything falls upon him because Gruden shows him the utmost in trust. And he leaves the defense completely alone. You can't leave the defense completely alone with someone who's never had to run it by themselves. And
exactly.
For me, it doesn't really work.
You know what I think, T? I think that, and this might sound crazy, but I think that Gruden, I mean, he's really, in a sense, taking his time with this. Like, I have time. Like, he has infinite time in football, you know, in football terms. A 10-year contract is really no rush. I mean, you want to win, but looking at the situation coming into Oakland the last time he was here and looking at it now, it's the sense of urgency isn't the same. And the thing with that is he's been to the top. He's built a, you know, he's built a winner. Let's say this. He put the final touches on a winner when he came between 98 and 2000. And then, you know, the Raiders lost the Super Bowl when he left. But I won't say he built that championship team in Tampa Bay. We know, obviously, what went on there. But with that being said, it's like he knows what you need to have. And when you look at the urgency, Gruden's selective with the urgency of what he wants to do. If you look at the draft picks, if you look at, you know, doing what, you know, going out there to get AB and some of the moves that he's made, it's selective. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are needs that he understands with the Raiders franchise better than anybody. And he had so much time to sit back and look at and observe how he was going to make this happen. The Raiders are going to have a lot of money this offseason. You know, they had money last offseason. They had draft capital. And I'm looking at these three third-round picks like I know that they're going to trade one or two or whatever to move up or something. And then I expect them to trade back to get more picks. He has a plan in mind, but, I mean, for the sake of the fan base, this has to speed up.
I agree. Now, we're going to put a pin in the Raider thing and kind of jump to the top story of the day. We have a special guest. She is a lawyer, proud Michigan alum, Anina Bakken. Anina, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing good. Thank
welcome.
You.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Now, for those who don't know, Nina is one of the sharpest legal minds and political minds you might find out there.
I don't know about all that, but thank you.
Now, we're not going to talk about your alma mater because they had a bad weekend, so we're going to, you know.
They had a really bad weekend. They had a terrible weekend. Oh, my God. I don't want to talk about it.
Now, for those who also don't know, Kamala Harris dropped out of the presidential race today. And, Nina, as someone who follows politics with a keen eye, let me ask you this question. In your opinion, where do you think the blame for Kamala Harris dropping out of the race should fall? Who would you, if you had to parse it and split it into parts about what contributed to this, how would you state that?
The DNC. I'd have to put some blame there. I also would, I mean, just the fact that she can't keep up with the money. That's, the amount of money that goes into this is kind of disgusting to me. I mean, if you really think about it, we have these billionaires coming in and spending all of their money, and they can spend till the end. But, yeah, I mean, the fact that she doesn't have the money to stay in the race, that's just a shame. We got to get the money out of politics. That's what I think.
I agree. Now, Obi, to you, where after the announcement, you saw a lot of, like, HOTEP types who were celebrating this because they're the folks who like to push the Kamala's a cop type narrative in the black community. Obi, to you, is if you see in the black community, Obi, like, when you see people who are spouting this nonsense, do you think that some of it is the resentment towards a black woman succeeding, or do you honestly think that there is a resentment because of people not considering her fully black because of a Jamaican father or, you know, Indian mother? It just, why do you think that she, in certain parts of the community, not totally, but in certain parts of the community, where do you think that resentment came from, Obi?
Well, you know what? You brought up a good point in terms of who's upset with her and a lot of in a lot of aspects, and that's the HOTEP community. You got to look at it like this. And this, I think this goes. I think this goes for Hillary as well. If Hillary would have won, but I say this, especially for Kamala with the black community, you got to look at it like this. I mean, most women make more money than men anyway. Most black women make way more money than black men anyway. You know, things are changing. Nowadays, you have a lot more stay-at-home dads than anything. You know. In a lot of aspects, the women are the breadwinners and, I mean, honestly, run their households. And a lot of HOTEP men look at it as, if you have this black woman in office, it's going to, they lose the dynamic of power and respect in their mind. You know what I'm saying? So it's like a lot of ways to look at it, but that's one way to really look at it. It's like, for that community, that this woman winning means that a lot of things. I mean, and then they were, a lot of them already have the perspective. Like I said, that was something I was ignorant about as well, with her, you know, sending the moms to jail and all that stuff. You got to really do your own research on a lot of things and look at things from a wider spectrum. But with that being said, for every person that says, let me do my due diligence to be more informed, there's two people that won't. You can, I mean, look at how all this stuff that people still believe that's been debunked. You know what I'm saying? So we're talking about a black woman being the president of the United States. The, you know, there would be a lot of people. It's just like with Obama. There would be a lot of a great percentage of the country that, because he's black, they didn't care what he said. He could do no right. Then we're talking about a black woman, and you gotta lie. I mean, people act like it's not true, but it is true. A lot of black men, black men don't have any respect or love for black women. You know, you see it all the time. And then, you know, when things like that happen, you know, when something like this, a disproportion happens, it would be a lot of backlash from certain parts of the black community.
I agree. Now, Nina, to you, when you look at how the other candidates framed maybe their critiques and criticisms of Harris, be it Berners, be it Tulsi Gabbard, be it Joe Biden, it seemed like it kind of dug a little bit deeper than policy. Like it felt like a touch personal. As a woman in this, especially as a black woman, just, and as someone in this climate, as far as the political climate, how much of what happened as far as her dropping out should fall on the shoulders of how her fellow candidates shaped the narrative surrounding her?
That's a tough one. as a woman watching all of this, I'm getting a really concerned. I can't believe what the debate stage is going to look like. It's going to be a whole lot of white men yet again, and it's disconcerting. I just can't believe we're right back to that status quo, and it's just disappointing. I don't know. I haven't taken it all in. I'm all in my feelings about it today. I'm upset. I'm upset that she's leaving the race, that she's out. I'm glad we have her on the Judiciary Committee to be on the, I don't know if you saw her tweet today, that our so-called president said, "Oh, too bad, we'll miss you," or something, and then along those lines, and she clapped back with, "I will see you at your trial, Mr. President." So it's good that we have her there.
Now, Obi, if you spin some of the backlash that Kamala Harris faced as far as parts of the media, especially some parts of the black media, be it Van Jones, who this is the clown who said, well, when Trump said something that wasn't completely assholish, that this is the day he became president. Little things like that. As far as part of the media narrative, do you honestly think that Kamala Harris got a fair chance? And if not, what could she have done differently? Or was it already sealed where she did what she could do, she did best she could, and the deck was stacked against her?
No, I don't at all think that. I thought that, I mean, it's a real shame that it came down to money. Because I feel like that even with that backlash early, I feel like she was in the best position to win out of all the Democratic candidates. I'm going to be real with you. And there's a lot of different reasons. And this is, sounds crazy to say, but I'm looking at all types of reasons. And just hear me out on this. Now, just looking at it, Castro can barely keep enough money to be relevant. Booker, he's tried so hard to appeal to the inner city, but outside of that, I don't really see anything in his campaign that like sticks out to me. And plus, now this is controversial, but I'm dead serious when I say it. Plus, for Booker, I think that many people will, not me, but many people will raise an eyebrow at his relationship with, what's her name?
Rosario
Dawson.
Yeah.
Rosario Dawson.
I mean, how many people will really think that it's real, for one? I mean, that's something that, I don't personally believe that the relationship is real. But yeah, I just, when I look at the candidates overall, and in past elections and, you know, election season, I think some of these people would have been in a much better shape. But you're looking at what you have to go against. To beat Trump, you're going to have to be an elite candidate. I'm not saying that Kamala Harris was, you know, an elite candidate, but she was much better than the rest, in my opinion. I mean, I don't think anybody else was close in terms of platform, in terms of overall, and in terms of the demographics that she could touch. Women, black women, black successful women, and poor black women, looking at it from a lot of different angles. And it was so much, when I really looked into her background, I said, she's going to get a large demographic of supporters from different, social classes of black people because of the fact that, one, she's a successful black woman that went to Howard. These are, you know, she's already debunked a lot of the things that are, you know, said about her, and she has an actual plan. By far, I just looked at everybody and said, okay, if she can deliver her speeches well and debate well, she's got a good chance of going head-to-head with Trump. I mean, when she got to that point of beating out everybody else in the Democratic Party, I thought it would be close, but I think that she had a good chance, man. And I knew, like I told T before we started, once I got the news, I knew this is exactly what he was going to be ready to go into. Because we really have to look at, I told T earlier, and I truly believe it, at this point, looking at the candidates, I'm not sure that there's anybody that can beat Trump. And I hate to say it, because there's so many ways, Trump impacts the country negatively, just by his rhetoric, just by winning, just by being white, just by the things that he says and does. I mean, let's be real. So many people that want to act like that want to ignore the negative connotations of what "Make America Great Again" really means and what it's really saying. You know, so it's like, with that being said, it's like it's so many ways. This is something that it's going to be hard, man. But I'm looking at the candidates and just thinking, like, man, just all around their platform, family life, everything. I'm really nervous to see who's going to represent the Democratic Party.
Now, Nina,
can I say a few things? Just, you know,
jump in.
Yeah. First of all, I just wanted to comment on the Rosario Dawson thing because I do find that kind of, you know, that really struck me as, is it a real relationship or not? Was she not a big Bernie supporter last time?
Yes, very big, very big, very big, very
okay.
big.
Okay. So, yeah, so I kind of find that interesting,
weird.
You know? You know, like, I'm not sure if that's to make Senator Booker look slightly more progressive than he is. I'm not sure, but who knows, right? It maybe it's love. Maybe it is love. But, yeah, I wanted to comment on that. And then, I got into that and I forgot what I was going to say. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. Now, to you, Nina. The other half of the media arm is the numerous amount of eulogies that were posted even shortly after Kamala Harris announced her candidacy. Announced her intention to run. People were starting to write the eulogies like on the spot, the post-mortem even before she got underway. And you see a lot of people on TV, be it MSNBC, CNN, Fox is trash, so we kind of know what they are. But we'll focus on MSNBC and CNN, where people were strictly trained upon trying to uplift Mayor Pete, and meanwhile trying to trash Kamala Harris for dancing at her alma mater or dancing at some fundraiser in Iowa. Do you think that in certain media corners that she wasn't going to ever be their candidate?
I kind of do. Yeah, I do. It's you know, I do like MSNBC. I like Rachel Maddow. I like Lawrence O'Donnell. I like my shows, and I know I'm getting a left-leaning opinion, but I usually believe they're giving me facts. But, yeah, I think they have their favorites, and I don't think she was one of them. I mean, they hardly ever talked about her, and it seemed, you know, when I saw today, they showed a clip of her announcement. How many people were out there? I mean, that was huge. She had a great start to her campaign, and to think that it just kind of fizzled out. You got to look at the media and how they, what their role is in it, and I don't think they were ever gonna push her, and I don't know why. I mean, I have my theories, of course. Oh, I know what I was going to say earlier, though. Right, I have my theories. But I know what I was going to say earlier about I would have loved to see Kamala Harris debate Donald Trump. I would have loved it, although he just is so ridiculous. I don't know how it would have played out because he doesn't answer a question ever. but it would have been nice to watch her just pick him apart. It would have been beautiful. Beautiful thing.
I think that he dodged a bullet here. I think he got lucky. Like, he got lucky. I think in his mind, his addled mind, that he thinks that was somebody who he didn't want to see on the debate stage because he would have tied fire to his ass in a heartbeat and made him look like even more of a fool.
Mm-hmm.
Obi, now, we're going to shift a little bit and kind of shift a little bit into the legal system. Like, Obi, first question is to you. When I say the words legal system, what are the first three things that come to your mind and why, being a black man?
Injustice, money, education. Educate. Let me say, do it. You want me to explain why I picked those things?
Of course.
So, I wouldn't say a running joke, but it's certainly true that in the inner city, a lot of times, the real inner city, a lot of black men don't pick up books on a large scale until they get to jail or prison. I mean, we're not talking about the everyday person. We're talking about the people that are in the struggle and make the wrong choices in life, and then they got to pick up where they left off. They're already 10 steps behind everybody else. These are the people that have been in the streets all their lives, and they might have had a speech impediment, stuttered or something like that, and had violent households and stuff. The kids that didn't read in class. These are the people that go out into the streets and do what they do and they end up in prison. And then they end up the guys that are in the law libraries all day and all night, helping people fight their cases in the court, in the jail, in prison system, and help them read over documents. These are those people. So with that being said, education on the legal system is something that many black people in the inner city and lower income communities, and I would say Hispanics too especially, don't have. I have a friend that stresses to kids all the time about how expensive it is to be a criminal. Court cases, bonds, being on house arrest, things like that. Lawyers, all of these things is very expensive. And then we know how expensive it is. We know that, I mean, on my experience with myself, friends, others, when you have a public defender, 9 times out of 10, in my opinion, you're going to result in getting some type of charge. They're going to try to get you to take some type of plea. And it's temporary gratification depending on what you did, because it'll get you lesser time or get you out, probation, et cetera, PBJ, something like that. But your record is affected. That starts the rabbit hole for your life if you're not careful. And a lot of times it's really, really hard for people to be careful. I say money because, like I said, if you can't afford a real lawyer for even the smallest of circumstances, a lot of times, it might not land you in jail or prison immediately, but it does have an effect on your life. So let's just look at the people in situations like, what if this, I'm not even going to say them because they ended up going to prison anyway. But let's say somebody that, a 15, 16-year-old kid, three or four 15-year-old, 16-year-old kids, they end up, wrong place, wrong time. They're in trouble. They're accused of raping a woman and killing her. They didn't do it, but because of the fact that they have a public defender who is not a bad person for having a lot of cases on their plate and trying to get rid of some of these cases, but they understand what they're doing too. They have a public defender or public defenders, and now these 15, 16-year-old kids are being into the system as adults or held in juvenile so they can be tried as adults. These are real things that happen every day. And then their childhood innocence is snatched. What people understand, it's on so many levels. There are people that come out of prison and jail and are good people. They went in good people. But what you have to understand is that we go to jail and prison in a system that tells us that we need to be on our best behavior, and that if we do have good behavior that we might can get out early or that we can just add more time to our sentence. But what it doesn't tell you and what it doesn't reprimand is the people that have already been hardened or had to harden themselves to survive in this environment. And with that being said, that's why so many people that we know are going to prison, and when you call home and say, well, they don't know when they're coming home. They just get to. That's the thing in my community. I'll be home soon. I can't tell you when I'm going to come home till I know when I'm going to come home. And even when I know I'm going to come home, I got to be even on more alert because these people that's around me probably know when I'm coming home too. and they're willing to do something to get me, you know, to try to kill me or put me in a situation to stay here because they're staying here. And I said, money, education, and injustice. I mean, on all levels. I mean, I have a friend, a father of three. He went to Morgan with me, and he can't drive his car because he had a situation in Georgia, and they've taken forever to give him a new tags and all of this paperwork and all this stuff, and he knows that if he gets caught driving this car because he doesn't have the paperwork, he's going back to jail. He can't afford it for something that he did at 16 and still affected him. Look at Meek Mill. I mean, this guy, and that, his injustice and his hardship was one of the greatest awakenings for America to say, okay, this guy, look at the level of the person that's going through this. Meek Mill was on probation for what, 11 years or something like that? I mean, and this guy saw this affect his career in so many ways that we were taking notice of it until the regular people said, something needs to be done about it. And this is a multimillionaire rapper. So what about the average Joe on the street? I just had a talk with a friend yesterday. He, you know, him and some other friends, I was 19, I was at Morgan, and they were 17 and 18. And they were all in a situation where they did something that, you know, a robbery that they automatically regret. They got caught. And it was a situation where I was there where they were trying to plan it. I said, don't do it, man. It's too many of y'all. It's a stupid idea, this and that and the other. It's not worth the cash that y'all would get for all of y'all doing it. And they, out of desperation, did it anyway. And, you know, these were close friends. The ones that are alive are close friends of mine. One of them is dead. Two are still in prison for that. And the one that I was talking to, mind you, he was 17 at the time. He was tried as an adult. And he, you know, did a little time and came home, and he was a felon. I mean, he's been in the system ever since. And he's had to walk a tightrope to you know, help himself in that situation. And with that being said, he's you know, he's doing his thing with HVAC and all of that stuff now, and he actually works for the Smithsonian here in D.C., and he's making good money and stuff, but he's trying so hard to do for others and kids that are in the system because he knows he got lucky. He's blessed to be able to be in a family that said, listen, when you come home, ain't no going outside. We're going to make sure that you get to all of your, you know, to check in with your PO and all of that stuff, whatever has to be done, you know. And everybody doesn't have that family structure. Everybody doesn't have a car. Everybody doesn't have money to go, you know, to go to parole or probation officers when they need to. These are all luxuries.
True. With that said, I know that, I mean, between the three of us, one of us is a lawyer. One of us passed the bar. One of us, you know, of the three of us, not me, but
no.
Nina, yeah. Where would you like to start? Would you? I mean, I got questions.
I don't even know where to start. I don't even know where to start. But yeah, I mean, but let's be clear. I'm not currently a lawyer.
Correct.
Right.
But you did pass the bar.
I did pass the bar. I'm not currently licensed.
No.
And
now, do you want questions or do you just want to tell the whole story?
You can throw some questions at me. I understand. Let's just say that I understand being a criminal defense attorney, and I understand being the criminal. So I understand all sides of the system at this point in my life, and it's the full 360 degrees of knowing what's what, and talking about getting caught up in the system and people not being able to pay off fines, you know, especially when it comes to even just driving. You know, your license is suspended, and then you're driving, and then you get arrested for a misdemeanor driving on a suspended license, and you're in trouble again. I mean, it just goes on and on. Once you're in the system, it's really hard to get out. It's so hard to get out, and sometimes over things that just aren't that big. It's troubling. But yes, ask away. Ask a question.
Now, before I start the question, I'll preface it by this. Nina is also a fantastic writer. She wrote her story in the most stark, brilliantly phrased detail that it was startling, and it was the absolute truth. Whew. But now that I've collected myself, we're just going to start at the beginning. After you graduate from law school and you have your own firm and things are moving for you, things are going well, what started the series of events that led you to this point? Like, where would you like to start off this story?
Well, you know what I always flash back to is law school orientation. I don't know why this sticks out to me, but we had a speaker who said 40% of attorneys become alcoholics. And I laughed it off and went to the bar directly with a bunch of fellow students. And, you know, but fast forward several years, you know, I had many years practicing that were successful. I practiced medical malpractice for a couple of years for a defense firm. Then I went to the plaintiff's side. And then I eventually had my own practice, and I practiced criminal defense and family law. And then I met a fellow attorney who I started dating and drinking with, and it was, I was 30, 31 when he introduced me to cocaine. And I was drunk the night that he introduced me to it, obviously. You know, I went to Michigan, hash bash, right? I smoked weed. You know, I drank like my peers, and I definitely had my share of marijuana, but not hard drugs until then. And it just, once he introduced me to that, I was just off and running with it. I was gone. I was so far gone. And the relationship became abusive. So I definitely understand those types of relationships now and how they start. So nice. It's, you know, he was very charming, very charming. A lot of my fellow attorneys would say the same thing. Oh, he's a nice guy, you know. He's so handsome. He's so this and that. And then once you're in it, slowly you notice that you're not spending time with your family and friends anymore. And I don't know. It's a long story. It's a very long story. But the drinking and the drugging got worse and worse, and then it started turning into drunk drivings. And I've had every consequence that an alcoholic and an addict could have, other than death, at this point in my life. And I just, I don't know, you can ask me another question.
Several things kind of like...
It's overwhelming. I mean, it's overwhelming, but I'm very open about it.
It is, and we appreciate that. When I read your story, because I read it several times.
Yes.
One of the things that I found interesting was the specific details. Like, there are three stories that stick out. So I want you to kind of give me, you know, one of them is the, if it has been a while since I read it, but the back of the pickup story.
Oh, the back of the pickup truck. That was a doozy. That was, So we had been drinking and coking one night, and we left my car. Okay, so I, just to kind of give the situation, we were practicing law in the Detroit metropolitan area. We lived in Oakland County, so the tri-county area of Detroit. You know, you've got Wayne County, Oakland County, Macomb County, and we lived in Oakland County. And so, you know, you have to drive around a lot, and many times we would leave a vehicle behind, and we left my vehicle behind one night, and the next night we went to get my car, and we were drunk again, and we were fighting, and he was sitting in his truck, and I had wedged myself in the door of the truck, not letting him leave, and he pushed past me and ran across this parking lot into a Kmart. And, you know, it's dark, and it was dark out, and it was that kind of rain that's sort of freezing, just freezing rain. It was just a cold, dark night. And he pushed past, ran into this store, and I ended up calling him. And we decided we would talk inside the store. So we wanted to try to work out our fight, make up, whatever, go home, do some cocaine, you know. And he said he was back by the toy section. So I told him, okay, you know, I said, I'm walking in the door where you walked in, and I'm, okay, what do I do? Do I go straight back? And he said, yes, come straight back in the store. Well, in the meantime, he ran out you know how stores can have two entrances? He ran out the other one to his truck and jumped in his truck and drove home. He was lying to me. He didn't want to talk to me at all. And the only way into our house was through a garage keypad, and you could disconnect it inside the garage. And so he put his truck in the garage, and he started climbing up on top of it to disconnect the plug. So if and when I came behind in my car, I wouldn't be able to get into the house. Well, then all of a sudden he heard coughing, like somebody was hacking and coughing, because lo and behold, I had been in the bed of the truck hiding the whole time. He had no, I mean, this is how messed up we were. This is how messed up it was. The whole time that he thought he was tricking me and outsmarting me and leaving me behind, I never went in that store. I knew exactly what he was going to do. I was in the bed of the truck talking on my phone, pretending to go in the store. And, just messed up, stuff like that. And you know what was the thing about the story? Was I told some of my friends years later after it happened, I told them this story, how I outsmarted him, and he, you know, had to give me some credit for being just crazier than him. But it didn't even strike me as anything odd. That was just any given day in my life in addiction. when insanity just makes perfect sense, that's when you're in full addiction. It just, you don't even notice that something is strange. And yeah, I didn't tell anybody about it, not because I was embarrassed or because I was ashamed or because, you know, of anything like that. I just didn't think it was abnormal. I didn't think it was abnormal behavior.
Now, another story is the major arrest, and give the details about the major arrest, like the...
The which one?
The major one, the felony?
Say that one more time.
Like the arrest about the seeing your boyfriend in jail. Like what was this? What was the details surrounding all of that?
Oh, my felonies?
Yes.
Yeah, that was, well, that was a different relationship. That was, well, I got out of the abusive relationship by going to treatment. I mean, I finally, you know, got some clarity, got enough clarity. Well, I got enough legal consequences that I decided to go to treatment. But while I was in treatment, and this is, you know, this ties into, I think, the, you know, criminal justice reform and dealing with addiction in this country and just trying to tie it all together for people. When I went to treatment, I only went in there for 17 days. 17 days. That is not long enough to get your head on straight, I guess. And I definitely got clean and sober, and I could see clearly, but I didn't listen to the things that I was told. And one of the things they told me was, do not get into a relationship. Well, I left rehab and I got into a relationship with someone I had been in treatment with. And he used heroin, and I was a drinker, and so I thought, okay, well, we won't use together because he didn't like drinking and I was never going to use heroin, right? But instead, we met in the middle and started using pills together. But yeah, again, that relationship, he ended up in jail, and I smuggled pills into him in the jail. I mean, there's so much more to the story, but that's what really cost me my law license. He was withdrawing. He had gone into jail with 60 milligrams of Xanax. I don't know if you understand prescription drugs, but that's a lot of Xanax. And I didn't know that he did that until I went to see him, and I saw him, and his eyes were just bloodshot and watery, and he just couldn't even focus on me. And when he stood up, he fell backwards and cracked his head right off of the concrete. And some deputies came and grabbed him and threw him into a cell. And I asked, aren't you going to get him medical attention? He just cracked his skull on the floor. And they said, he can kite the nurse when she goes by. And I'm thinking, this guy can't even see straight. He can't write a kite to anybody. He can't take care of himself. And when I talked to him, he told me he had the 60 milligrams of Xanax and he had taken all of it within 24 hours. And I feared that he was going to have seizures and possibly die, which, it is a possibility when you're withdrawing off of many substances, sadly. And so I did bring in his Xanax to him and smuggled it in, and we got caught, and well, he got caught and he ratted me out, and the next thing I knew, my home was being raided and my life was flipped upside down. And this is so in a nutshell, but of my story. There's a whole lot in between there, but that was in 2010, and that was a long time ago. So I'm happy to be away from those relationships, be away from, you know, drinking. It'll be 3 years actually in January since I've had a drink, and I could not feel better about it. It's really nice to not have that.
I was just about to ask about recovery, where
yeah.
you have
yeah,
made. It's been a lot. Like over the last 3 years, let's say 5 years, you've had to deal with a lot of things, be it with addiction, just life in general. Looking
right.
back over the last 5 years, where are you today? Like mentally, everything. Like where are you? Like where do you stand?
Well, I'm on probation right now for my law license. There's a possibility that I can get it back. I will have to petition the state. I have to petition to get it back and go for a hearing. And sadly, because it's been so long, I might have to take the bar exam again. The bar exam. Oh, my goodness. There may be a loophole. I don't know. I have to do some more research, which thankfully I'm good at. But I'm on probation to get my law license back. I will probably petition in the spring. It'll be 3 years, January 24th, since I've had a drink. And this go around, I don't know how to explain it. And I do go to meetings. I have a therapist. But it's something spiritually happened where I don't want to drink. It's a really incredible feeling to have that happen and have that urge and that constant thought. You know, it's kind of an obsession and a compulsion. You know, something bad happens and you think, oh my God, I need a drink. Something good happens, well, I'm gonna have a drink. You know, and for me, when I pick up a drink, I don't know what's gonna happen. I know I'm going to drink a lot, and I know I'm going to change, and I'm probably going to become a really horrible person. So it's just nice today to have the choice to not pick up that drink. And lo and behold, I don't commit crimes. I don't smuggle drugs into jails. I just, you know, I can live a much more calm life. It's certainly not perfect, but it's manageable for the most part, and it's a good life. The difference today is I actually want to live, because the way that I spiraled, it became a suicide mission, truly. It really was. I was just ready to die so many times, and there were many times I woke up and I was upset that I woke up, because I'd hoped that I had, you know, finally taken myself out of this world. And today I want to live, and it's a pretty incredible feeling. And the fact that I'm alive, the things that I've been through, overdoses, and, you know, I had an overdose where somebody left me in an overdose. And when I contacted them the next day, they said, oh my God, thank Jesus, you're alive. And I thought, what? Oh, you left me to die. Oh, okay. You know, and I just went with it, because you can't be mad at the game when you're in it, you know. But, wow, today I'm just so happy to be alive and to have a chance to figure out a new path in life. And that may include a law license, and it may not. And I can accept that either way. I really can.
Obi, do you have any questions?
Yes, actually, I do. Yeah, I'm here. Right. Yes, mm-hmm. I do have a question. just mm-hmm. like what let me just ask you with that story, I mean, I just want to commend you for the bounce back and just like persevering through all of that. But if you had to sum up the journey for yourself in one word from where you were to where you're at, I'm talking about the relationships, the drinking, just to now, mm-hmm. what would that word be and why?
One word? Miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really is miraculous that I am not, I'm not, that I'm alive, but that, it really hits me sometimes that I'm so grateful that I didn't hurt other people. You know, there were many times I drove in blackouts. I mean, one of my drunk drivings, I was a 0.33 alcohol level, and that should be a coma for most people. But for me, I was walking and talking, and I came out of a blackout in jail, and I didn't know why I was there, and they could have told me that I'd killed somebody, you know. And I can sit here today, and it's a miracle that I didn't hurt somebody else or kill somebody else with all of the terrible things that I did. It's a lot to get over the guilt and the shame of all the things that I've done, but.
Now, it's weird for me just on a minute level. I've read this, like I said, you know I've read this a million times. But mm-hmm. to hear it and, you know, to hear it from the person who, from their viewpoint and to who has lived it, even though I know what is about to happen, even though I know what the next thing was about to happen, it's still stunning that it. I mean, that's a lot. That's a few lives. That's a few lifetimes right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now we always tend to, when we end on a lighter, happier note. So I have a question for you. I have a question.
Okay.
Actually, I have two questions, but one is a food question. Now, being from Michigan, where is your favorite place to go for just either diner food or something like greasy junk food where you just want to sit there and just stuff your face? And why?
Ooh. Anywhere in the state of Michigan?
Anywhere.
Oh, Blimpy Burger in Ann Arbor. Oh my God, I miss that place. if you've been to Ann Arbor, then you know what I'm talking about. And boy, those burgers. I mean, they make like multi-patty burgers for you. I mean, you just get to direct every which way they're going to do it. Sauteed onions, just delicious. Oh my God, I miss it. I would possibly drive to Ann Arbor just to go to Blimpy Burger. It's that good.
Now, Obi, where is your favorite, like, greasy spoon spot?
I would have to say Marathon Deli in College Park, literally right behind the University of Maryland. It's not overly, well, it is kind of greasy. It's a Greek spot, but in terms of like eating with your hands, it's one of the best spots in the entire area. They have, and I told you I love chicken parmesan. They have the best chicken parmesan sub I've ever had in my life.
Mm.
And every Wednesday, it's like I said, it's on the campus, so it's an after hours spot. I think they go to like 3 o'clock in the morning, even on Sundays. And, like, it's the spot, the line is out the doors. It's, like, the place is, like, the size of a damn basement. But it's, like, the line is always out the door. The chicken parm sauce is dripping, and they got this marathon sauce and everything. And it's so good. It's amazing. I will spend that $10 gladly, gladly.
Now, there's a place in New Haven, Connecticut, like, I always argue with friends about deep dish pizza, which I cannot stand, versus East Coast pizza. There's a place in New Haven, Connecticut, not, you know, same town as, like, Yale University, all these schools, Frank Pepe's Neapolitan pizza. I cannot tell you, like, how good this pizza is. It is heaven by the slice. It is a thinner crust, but the layers of meat and the layers of cheese are just, I'm stuck in the middle of Wisconsin right now, and I am hungry for it right now. It's about 10:15, and I could honestly make that trip. And one of the first things I did remember when I walked in, one of the first times, this person ahead of me asked if they could have pineapple on the pizza. The look on the cashier's face and the disdainful, like, smirk and the, no, you can't, made me know that I was in the right place. I was home, and just with, like, a bottle of ginger ale and, like, a pie, and you can either split it with somebody or just get your own, which I'm going to get my own. Get my own and take some home. It is the greatest pizza I have ever had. But, Nina, also, speaking of, since you mentioned that you're a proud Michigan alum,
mm-hmm.
How much longer do you want Jim Harbaugh around your program and your school?
Yeah, he can go. Yeah, he can go now. I'm sorry. I try to be loyal and give people chances, but yeah, I think he can leave. I think it's time for somebody new. Is that a
Jim?
How's that answer?
That is a good answer. Jim Harbaugh, kind of, to me, like, there's an old saying, like, or a recent saying, you know, he is the opposite of don't go bleeping this up. And he has bleeped it completely up for the University of Michigan. He has driven into the ground. Obi, if you are the University of Michigan, what do you do?
That's a good question. Well, for one, I'm getting rid of him. But I'm I'm looking at the prospects out there. You know what? I'm gonna be honest with you. With Dion, you know, getting the interest and everything from Florida State, I'd get the people talking. I'd offer Charles Woodson the head coaching job.
Ooh. Wow.
I could see that. It would definitely stir up the fan base. Like, people, to me, as an outsider, I have been to games at Ann Arbor and ones at the Horseshoe in Columbus during the rivalry, and they want to say it's a rivalry. I want both of these teams to be good at the same time because I want to see that rivalry. Like, I remember that rivalry being good where poor John Cooper could never beat Ohio State when they had Bo Schembechler as coach, and then they had Lloyd Carr. And I want the schools to be good at the same time. Like, Michigan, they're good, but Ohio State is miles ahead. I want this rivalry to be good because there's nothing like that good, strong dislike to the simple fact that people in Ohio during that week won't use the letter M in writing or anything else. And they will refer to the school as that school up north. They won't even put respect on Michigan's name. They will just say, that school up north, random. They just give you, like, a random name. With that said, Nina, I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us. And let's just say I have a feeling that you will be I want you to, you know, feel free to jump in anytime as our political contributor because you follow politics as ardently and as strongly as most people, and you are not shy about expressing your opinion. Never have been.
No, never. I was voted most outspoken in high school. So.
No. Not true.
Yes. True fact.
You are welcome. anytime that you want to come on if there's something in the politics landscape that happens and, you know, you want to jump on and vent your spleen or have a moment, the door is open. Where can people find you if they want to follow you on Twitter?
I am at Nines Marie on Twitter.
All right. Now, Obi, can you tell about the book, what you have to work on, and where can they find you?
Yes. The book is called Bounce Be Baby. It's about Washington, D.C. and Maryland's go-go scene, why it's important to me, why it's important to us, and it's just a big part of my life story. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, etc. Right now, I'm working on draft profiles. The hashtag is Road to 400. She has been working very, very hard. Every day, new draft profile. Like you said, got one coming tomorrow. Somebody we've talked about a lot. You know, for a lot of people, the draft season doesn't start until the NFL season is over. But for us, that's not the case. You know, so we're into it every day. And, yeah, just working on draft profiles. And it's that time of the year where I'm like, you know, getting ready to go to Combine, getting ready to go to the draft, getting ready to go to Senior Bowl, all types of things. So, and then I'm getting ready to go to Oakland in a few, well, not even 2 weeks for the last game. So just getting prepared.
See, you can find me at T Biggs. That's capital T, capital B, lowercase, everything else. I, political rantings, kid pictures, my kids are growing like ridiculously and causing me stress and gray hair. Food rantings, I judge people for poor mac and cheese choices. And, oh, speaking of, Nina, what is your favorite pie?
Favorite pie?
Mm-hmm.
Favorite pie. I like a good apple pie, but it's got to have that crumble top. You know?
You know what? Like, can I just say something? Because I'm sitting here slow chewing, eating the last of the apple pie a la mode from Thanksgiving. And it's just like amazing that you say that. Because I'm like trying to be as quiet as possible.
Yes. Maybe, well, they enjoy, but yes, a good apple pie with a crumble top. Come on, so delicious. Otherwise, I gotta go with like a good French silk.
Oh, so
like a good, yeah, good French silk chocolate pie. You know.
Oh wow! I am a sweet potato, but an apple pie. There is a Meijer that was just built, the first one in town, and they have a good apple pie. Where I'll go now, but I want to go to the gym instead because, yes, as you reach 40, it is easy. It is tougher to lose weight and to stay in shape. So that pie will have to wait to a gym day. But, Nina, like I said, the door will always, always be open, and I hope that you will walk through it. This is, you know, I am ecstatic to talk to you again. It is phenomenal. Obi, we will see you next week. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thanks both, and thanks to both of you. I had a good time. Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of the Black Tuesday Podcast. Be good to yourselves and be good to each other. Good night.